Welcome to the Trinity Heights Church podcast. I'm Stephen Chern, and we are a community of Christians and skeptics exploring the biblical narrative together. Our reading this morning is taken from 1 Kings chapter 18, and I'm just going to read a couple of verses from verses 16 to 18. Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now, summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So, this morning we are in the third part of our series, which we've titled The Prophetic Imagination. And they are all being recorded, so if you've missed a couple, we are going to be putting those on the website soon. But this week, just to quickly recap what we said last week. So what we did last week, for those of you who weren't here or those of you who weren't listening, we contrasted two different types of imagination. We contrasted, if you remember, the prophetic imagination with what we're calling the imperial imagination. The imperial imagination, if you remember, says that this is the way things are. This is the way things have always been, and this is the way things are always going to be. In other words, the imperial imagination is very good at propagating the myth of its own eternity. The prophetic imagination is able to see through the way that the now is being presented. Moreover, it has access to deep and abiding memories, ancient memories, so that it can remember the past differently. And because the prophetic imagination can see through the way that the now is being presented and can remember the past differently, the prophetic imagination has the ability to imagine and hope for an entirely different future. Of course, in order to be able to do all this, the imagination has to be, first and foremost, has to be free. And we said that the prophetic imagination finds that freedom in relationship with the God who is completely and utterly free. Well, the freedom of God is something that if we don't mention it explicitly every single week in this series, just know that it's operating in the background of everything we're saying, because the freedom of God is foundational and absolutely fundamental to everything we're talking about, the operation of the prophetic imagination. But today we're going to take our focus from the freedom of God explicitly and focus on the freedom of the prophetic community, because the prophetic imagination finds its freedom in relationship with a community that is completely free. I'll say that again. The prophetic imagination finds its freedom in relationship with a community that is free. This may seem a little counterintuitive at first. In fact, a friend here this morning was just on the very first week of this series in our discussion group brought up a very good point. They said their impression had been that the prophets were sort of operating, working alone, and that the whole point of a prophet is that they're this lone voice over and against the rest of society. And you certainly, if you just flick through the Old Testament, you're going to get this impression, because what have you got? You've got books by the major prophets, and then you've got the minor prophetic books, and they're all got titles, and the titles are what? They're names of individuals, right? Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and the rest. And so we get this impression that actually the prophetic ministry is the calling of and the vocation of these particular individuals always working alone. Sometimes the prophets felt alone. I think the classic example is Elijah, when Elijah is off in a cave somewhere, a little bit on from this episode I just read, and he's off in a cave somewhere and he's going, "God, why don't you just kill me? Just end it. I don't want to carry on. I can't do this anymore. I want to die." And in his isolation, he's feeling suicidal. But actually, he was wrong. Even then, even though he keeps saying, "I'm alone, I'm the last one left, I'm the only one standing, I'm the only one faithful to God, I'm alone," he says it a lot, but actually he's not alone. Because just a little earlier, we read this in Kings. "Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab had summoned Obadiah, his palace administrator. Obadiah was a devout believer in the Lord. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with bread and water." So Elijah's not actually alone. He operates out of a prophetic community. Give you another example, going back to the archetypal prophet Moses that we talked about last week, right? We said he's the archetypal prophet. God calls him, and what does he say? Oh, yes, Lord, I'll go and do what you... No, no, no. He says, I can't do this because I'm not very eloquent. That's what he said. I'm not very eloquent. And I'm slow in tongue and speech, so I can't do this. And God says, well, that's okay, because your brother's a smooth talker, isn't he? So your brother Aaron and you, I'm going to bring you together. The two of you are going to meet up, and you're going to work together, and you're going to do this together. And so then they go, but they don't go to Pharaoh straight away. What they do is they go to the elders of Israel. They gather up the elders of Israel, and so is the beginning of a prophetic community, because they start to cultivate the prophetic imagination in the nation of Israel. And they say, can you remember a different past? And can you imagine a different future? So the prophetic imagination is something, this is the first takeaway, is something that is meant to be cultivated in the context of community. But what does that community look like? How do we know when it's a genuine article? How can we tell when it's the real thing? It's not a very easy question to answer, to be honest, because even in, for example, in Elijah's day, who we're thinking about this morning, Elijah, there were other prophetic communities. I say that in inverted commas, right? I'm saying prophetic communities. Because as long as we've had prophetic voices, and this is what makes it difficult, as long as we've had prophetic voices, we've had people who are able to ape the prophetic voice, who pretend to bring a voice from beyond, who ventriloquize the voice of God, but we must beware of cheap imitations. So for example, Elijah, you know, he has this famous confrontation, a little bit on from our reading this morning, with the prophets of Baal, and he does that at Mount Carmel. Let me just read you that section again. It's short. Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" I love that designation for prophets, troublers, right? Troublemakers. "You troubler of Israel. I've not made trouble for Israel," he says, "but you and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So you see, there are at least two different communities claiming to be prophetic in that time, the prophets of Baal, prophets of Asherah. But Elijah drops in this really interesting detail. He refers to them as people who eat from the table of Jezebel. That's a really important detail, because what does this tell us? This tells us that these people went to the same dinner parties, right? And they played on the same golf courses, and they flew on each other's private jets. This is Elijah's way of saying, well, the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Asherah, they're bought and paid for. They directly benefit from the established order. For good or for bad, they directly benefit from the established order, and therefore they have no interest in issuing any sort of challenge from beyond. So you see what the author of Kings has done there, right? He's given us two very nice contrasts that we can make. On the one hand, you've got these prophets who are on the run and they're in hiding, 50 to a cave, living on rationed out bread and rationed out water provided by the generosity of Obadiah, who's just taken sympathetic with them, right? He's doing this in secret. He's against the king. He's hiding them out there. And there's that community of prophets which Elijah would have belonged to, and then there is this other community of prophets who eat from Jezebel's table. And this is a culture where people can be bought, and that's fine if you can be bought. And if you can't be bought, then they'll kill you. So there's this culture of fear. So if you just imagine yourself sitting around Jezebel's table, they all know what to say and when to say it, and they all know when to laugh or to force a laugh, and they all know that there are things that it doesn't do to say. It's a sort of coerced agreement. Uniformity. And then there's that group of prophets sitting around Jezebel's table, and then there's the others who are living on rations of bread and water because they refuse to be bought and to align themselves. Connecting this to something of our own, you know, American history, think of the McCarthy era, right? 1947 to 57, that there was the Red Scare. Actually, I think it was technically the second Red Scare, but the Red Scare, right? And what happens then? Well, there's all sorts of areas of life that we could look at in America, but let's just focus on one area, the academy. It's estimated that around 100 college professors were fired for reasons real or imagined because of their sympathies with the communists. And of course, this McCarthyism, these witch hunts, became sort of the icon of the worst example of illiberalism on college campuses in American history. During that time, Paul Lazarsfeld and Wagner Thielens, they did a survey of almost 2,500 professors right in the middle of the Red Scare, right in the middle of it. And one of the questions they asked them was, how much do you find yourself editing yourself? How much self-censoring do you find yourself doing? And an astonishing, close to 10%, 9% 9% of them, which historically is really bad, 9% said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. Because of the circumstances, I'm having to self-censor myself all the time. But here's the thing. In the last 10 years, we've had more than 1,000 campaigns to punish college professors. Of those, about 2/3 have succeeded in some sort of retribution on those particular professors for exercises for having a different opinion, right? For having a different view of things. Almost 200 of them, so nearly twice as many as were fired during the Red Scare, 200 were fired. And when it comes to self-censoring, forget 9%, they're more close to like 90% of professors are saying, yeah, I'm self-censoring. I'm censoring myself. I'm getting some smiles and nods from one or two people who know the business, right? Yeah, I have to self-censor. And of course, this is a reflection of a broader cultural problem. And it's a problem where there's a constant threat that if you don't go along with the correct speech sanctioned by the major institutions, then you're out. And I know that some of you became adults over the last 10 years or so, right? So for you, this is normal. And this is why it's really, really important to have access not only to your own memories, but the memories of the community, a prophetic community, which can remember that this isn't the way things have always been. This is nothing normal about this. From one point of view, it hasn't always felt like you're sitting around Jezebel's table or some approximation of that. It felt different around Jesus' table at the Last Supper. If we go back to the night of Christ's betrayal, what we find is that there's the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Sanhedrin and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and there's King Herod, and there is also the Roman governor. And what you find is that all of these people and all of these institutions were completely aligned with each other. And the problem is that Jesus won't align himself with the institutions. He just won't do it. Well, can he be bought? Can he put his ministry on pause? No, he's not going to do that. And so they're going to have to crucify him. And so it's in that context of this oppressive culture of fear, that this conformity under the imperial imagination, Jesus was about to become a victim of the imperial imagination. But you know what Jesus does right there? In that context, Jesus, on the night of his betrayal, offers his disciples and offers us our freedom. He offers us our freedom. And you might wonder, well, where does Jesus talk about freedom? I don't see him use that word in that context. Well, he does. This is what he says in the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, a new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. What are the conditions there that he lays out around that? I don't think there are any. I don't think he says, you know, agree with, well, he doesn't say a new command I give to you, as I've said before, a new command I give to you, agree with one another as I have agreed with you. He doesn't do that. He doesn't say, love those people who agree with you, love those people who have aligned themselves with the predominant surrounding culture and the major institutions. Love those people who affirm you and your way of doing things. Can you imagine Jesus saying, well, I love you if you affirm me? I just can't. I'm just trying to hear Jesus say those words. I don't think those words are going to come out of his mouth. There are no conditions on that. Jesus says, I've loved you, and I want you to love each other the same way. In fact, Jesus says, you know, what good is it if you just greet those who greet you? What good is it if you love those who love you? So at Trinity Heights, one of the ways that we try to sum this up, and it's really one of our mantras, is this. We say that there is no idea or identity. And I just want you to take a moment to think about that aspect of yourself which you find is just drilled into you and it's just part of who you are, your identity. And think about your most cherished ideas, the ones that you go, this is the most important thing. And I just want you to think about that for a moment. There is no idea and no identity that is more important than loving the person in front of you. I think that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying there's no idea, no identity that you possess that is more important than you loving the person in front of you. Nothing gets elevated above that. If there is something that gets elevated above that, you've got to try and imagine Jesus saying that. You've got to try to, can you hear Jesus saying that sentence? I don't think so. And so what this means is, and I'll just wrap up here, what this means is that no matter what we do, we don't walk away from each other. And you know what that cultivates? What that cultivates is freedom. This is why I say, just as Jesus has been going to be crucified, he is offering, just as he's about to get crushed by the imperial imagination, he's offering us our freedom. Because when we love each other like Jesus loves us, we're free to be honest. So what this love does is this love produces, it cultivates freedom. The freedom creates more love. And so this love and freedom are the wellspring of the prophetic imagination. Well, what I want us to do now, before we have our discussion groups later, what I want us to do is to respond to this by taking communion together. So what is communion? Why do we share communion? What is the point of this? Well, that's a multifaceted question, and it's so rich in symbolism and meaning. But let's just focus on this one thing. On the night of Christ's betrayal, Jesus takes bread and he says, "This is my body given to you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup and says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." Jesus is saying, "I give you my body, my flesh. I give you my blood. I give you myself. I give myself for you on your behalf. I give you myself." And here's the thing. When he says, "Do this in remembrance of me," not just eat bread and take wine. He means do this. I'm giving myself for you. I want you to give yourself for each other. That's the invitation. And that's what we remember. Now look, this morning you may be coming from a place of deep faith. On the other hand, you may be coming from a place of deep skepticism. You're not sure about everything. Regardless of where you are on that scale, and just so you know, people around Christ's table on the night of his betrayal were coming from all sorts of different directions, different places, some from deep skepticism. But regardless of where you are, if you've heard something this morning, go, "Yeah, that Jesus, that's who I want to be like." Or, "Yes, I want to belong to a community like that." And no matter what, we don't walk away from each other. Then I invite you to come and share communion.
The Trinity Heights Church podcast is recorded right here in New York City. If you happen to be in the city, then feel free to join us in person. You can get more information about our service times through trinityheightschurch.com. Also, if you feel compelled to contribute to the ongoing ministry of Trinity Heights Church, then go to our giving page. Thanks for listening. Thank you.